Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society equips and encourages Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. To learn more about us, our events, our journal, Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Before we begin, I'd like to open with a prayer, and this is a collect for knowing and loving God from the Book of Common Prayer, and I think it's prescient for this particular discussion. O God, the light of the minds that know you, the life of the souls that love you, and the strength of the wills that serve you, help us so to know you that we may truly love you, and so to love you that we may fully serve you, whom to serve is perfect freedom, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. I'm grateful to be joined today by Paul Gutteker. Paul serves as executive director of the Brazos Fellows in Waco, Texas, alongside his wife, Paige, who is the assistant director. He holds a PhD in history from Baylor University and an MA in theological studies and a THM in history of Christianity from Regent College, Vancouver, right?
That's right.
He has written several books, including The Old Faith in a New Nation, American Protestants in the Christian Past. That's from Oxford back in 2023. And most recently, Practicing Life Together, A Common Rule for Christian Growth, Moody Publishers, 2025. Paul, Paige, and their four children enjoy living in Waco, where they like to fish, go camping, and cheer on the Buffalo Bills. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks, Josh. Great to be on and talk with you.
Yeah, man, so I want to talk about the Brazos Fellows and your new book, but first of all, let's start with why Buffalo?
Yeah.
Why Buffalo very happy, Bills?
Very happy to talk about it. I mean, I'm from there, so it might be that you find Bills fans these days with Josh Allen, you might find people who are fans all over the country, but it used to be that you had to be from there no one would ever choose that kind of suffering. But no, I was born in Rochester and my family's all from Western New York originally. Didn't really grow up there much, but still holding on to that, still rooting on our Bills. And it's a source of sanctification, I hope.
Well, as a Lions fan, I think I'm actually holier than you in that. I don't think that's right. How it works. Do you miss the snow?
You know, it's funny, I do, but I have to admit that that's a little bit romanticized because I got to mostly just enjoy it as a kid. And so all the fun parts, all the snow days, all the sledding, and not as much of the life, you know, hassle and day-to-day hardship. So,
yeah, right now here in West Michigan, it is in the teens, and there's just over a foot of snow here in Holland, Michigan. And I'm not a fan. It's just too early. Like it just dumped on us on Thanksgiving and then has not let up. I mean, I'm getting used to it. One of these days I'm going to get a snowblower so I can not die. But
that sounds a good call.
For now, it's just, I want to believe I'm still young enough to not worry about that. But after the, after the first 2 feet of snow, I'm not going to do that. All right. Now, there is, and you and I have talked, we talked several years ago briefly about what you were doing, and there's a lot of overlap between Brazos Fellows and the Ciceronian Society because we're both deeply interested in the formation of Christians. We want bigger, deeper Christians rather than superficial affiliation, right? Mm. And your focus is primarily on emerging adults in a very particular place in Waco. And I've heard so many good things about what you're doing from a number of people I respect deeply, as well as from Ciceronian Society members. And so first, let's just get started and tell us in basic sense what Brazos Fellows is. Explain how it got started and where the name comes from as well.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Let me start with that last one because it's the easiest. It's just the name of the river here in Waco. So the Brazos River cut through Texas, and it was discovered by Spanish explorers who were running out of water, and they named the river the Brazos de Deus, the arms of God, because they felt like they had fallen into the arms of God when they encountered this river of life. The tree planted by a river. So yeah, the fellowship is named after Waco's river, and it's a post-college 1 year academic year program. Folks come from around the country to be part of it. And it's pretty simple. We live by a common rule of life together. We say we sort of bottom line the four pillars of the program as we're practicing spiritual discipline. So this is praying the daily office together, practicing Sabbath rest, these sorts of things. We study theology, so we do a course of study in the great texts of the Christian past. We share life together, so lots of time around the table, seeking to know and be known. And we seek to discern God's call in our life. So you can think of it as a year of deep spiritual and theological formation, perhaps for somebody who isn't quite sure where life is going and wants some help and support in thinking well about that. Or often we get folks who kind of do have a good sense of what they want to do, but they feel a real hunger, a real need to grow in their faith and in their theological understanding before jumping into the next big thing. And if that's what the program is, where it came from is we found ourselves here in Waco. We've been here 11 years. We came for the doctoral program, and we found ourselves in this community of kind of like-minded grad students who we all desire to serve the church with our teaching and our scholarship. And we found ourselves in this kind of really rich community where we'd get together for meals and discussions. We began praying the daily office together. And we realized that the kind of community that was organically happening really met a need we were hearing from 20-somethings and undergrads about, which is some sort of structure and support for figuring out what the Christian life should look like on your own, right? I mean, you grow up in your family's house with your parents, hopefully in a good church, and then you go to college, and a lot of things are sort of structured for you in college. And then you kind of like, welcome to the quote unquote real world, good luck. And that there was a real, a real hunger to not go it alone in those formative years. And so in 2018, we launched Brazos Fellows, and folks showed up to do it. And we're now in our eighth cohort, and it's been a real joy to see what's happened in each cohort and the growth and the lasting fruit of a year by that common rule.
Is it a full-time program, or is it something that you essentially you live in Waco and you do something else and then this on the side, or is it kind of a full-time fellowship?
Yeah, it fellows do have the ability to work part-time. So it is the kind of thing where you can hopefully make enough to pay rent and still, work some sort of good part-time job here in town and still really give yourself to the study and the life and community and that work of prayerful attention and discernment. So yeah, I should say the last thing about the story, and we can talk more about this too, is we initially envisioned it as very much a post-college year, right? You graduate, and this is a kind of very intentional gap year. But we've seen in every year, folks come along not just a couple years removed, but in their late 20s and even early 30s. We've had folks who, somebody who was working on their dissertation, somebody who'd been in pastoral ministry as a counselor and got burned out and moved, with his family to Waco to do this. And while the sweet spot is still probably that post-college, those bridge years, you might call them. I mean, life continues to take twists and turns for a lot of people. And so I think that then, we're seeing that there's a hunger for this kind of semi-monastic, rigorous, communal experience. That transcends just, I'm fresh out of college.
Yeah, and that moment after you, especially after undergrad, I took a year off and got married, but which is a big deal. But it still feels like I was headed to grad school, but it was you almost feel like you're in free fall because just like you said, all this stuff is structured for you. It's you take for granted that until a certain age. There's just there's a path you follow, right? Okay, this grade, then this grade. And then when I get to this grade, I do this and this grade. It's not that scripted, but at the same time, all of a sudden you're done with undergrad and it's like, well, what in the world am I going to do? It's an emotionally, spiritually difficult moment in your life. And for some, as I think you're kind of suggesting is there, they're still there, years after they've left college in some cases,
Totally.
which I mean I'm sympathetic to. I mean, you can quote unquote figure it out. Let's say, like, I went to grad school and then did it for 10 years, and then and then was like, okay, now what do I do? Because I think there's I think we get to these similar moments where it's like, gosh, I just need something. I need this path to just plant my feet on, for lack of a better word.
Yes.
And so, yeah, that's interesting. So it is the cohort getting older then, in a way, or?
I'd still say the average fellow is coming out or a year out of college, but every year we have somebody who doesn't quite fit that bill.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think you're exactly right. There is this sense of vulnerability and free fall, and there's also this, it's an opportunity, right? There's whether we like it or not, some of the choices that people make in those post-college years, they can really set a trajectory for life. And I think that's part of why they feel fraught. I think churches and colleges and other institutions, I think we're kind of aware of this, but I don't know. I mean, colleges are so motivated and universities are so motivated to be able to say, 98.5% of our graduating class got a prestigious fellowship or a job or into grad school. They are so motivated to not encourage you to take the time to figure out what just happened, right? So you have to, I mean, it drives me crazy that I talk to these seniors all the time who say things like, well, actually, I wish I had studied history, or I would love to go, explore this set of questions, but I've already kind of committed to business school, or I've already got a job offer. And you can tell already, like, I can see where this is going. You're going to wake up in 5 or 10 years and you're going to hate what you do. And, but they, it's already been predetermined. They can't actually even be a senior. They can't take the capstone classes that are supposed to sort of be the apex of what they learned so far and then discern what this might mean for them. They've made those commitments a year or two before. And we're, there's a fine line there. I mean, we need to be practical, and we, of course, there's like ballooning college costs, and I'm aware of all those arguments, but we're in such a rush to say, you have to be productive right away. You have to have it all figured out at 21. I think that's just unrealistic. And frankly, it's naive. I mean, just statistically speaking, if you look at how frequently Americans are changing jobs, how that's accelerating, how it's true, what was true for our grandparents is definitely not the reality anymore, and not even our parents, and even the difference between your and my generation and a college kid coming up right now in terms of what they face in terms of jobs and mobility. So we're just not doing them any favors by saying, figure it all out before you graduate, and then go, and don't do any more of that hard work of self knowledge and discernment. And yeah, try stuff. I'm not arguing sit on your couch or go play video games for a year. Try things, but we need to be, I think, much more realistic about that process. And the church, that's the academy side. The church, I just don't think we have a category for this yet. We have children's ministry and youth ministry. We have college ministry. We have, like, what, young singles? We just are not aware that those years are going to set again a spiritual trajectory. It's when people are leaving the church, right? And we can either lean into the opportunity there that those bridge years provide, or we're going to see people find other sources of community and belonging and friendship. And so anyway, that was a bit of a long rant, but I completely underscore what you described as your experience. It was mine too.
And I think it's, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, for lack of a better word, unlearning what our expectations should be going forward. And you're fighting against this current of what adulthood is like or is, right? And what community is, what friendship looks like as an adult. And I think this could turn into a whole different podcast than what we planned, but I mean, I think there is a lot of truth to these moments of transition and searching and saying, okay, God, what now? And some of those times, uncomfortably, it doesn't play well for the stats that every university wants to have. But look at the Bible. We get to points where people are waiting for a long time to move into the next stage or different thing or to land, right? We recently were studying Moses with my son in a group, and the astonishing, first of all, the Israelites are in Egypt for 400 years after Joseph dies. 400 years. It's ridiculous. And then Moses, he kills the Egyptian, runs away, goes to, he's in Midian for 40 years. 40 years, which is just nuts to me. And then again, we get to the end of the Old Testament. There's this promise right at the end in Malachi, and you have another 400 years. It really is against what we normally we want to. I mean, I'm certainly I'm as impatient as they get, and I just want to get yeah right right raise your hand in the crowd if you're impatient. This is a confession podcast, but it's so true. And we need these moments of rootedness and practicing life together, to use your book's title, that we're just not getting at the right times in our lives, and we're struggling to get it. Now, one of the things I want to ask, and again, we can keep coming back to that theme. When I read your website, as an Anglican, I recognize right away this is a very Anglicanish program. But is it primarily for Protestants, or would you think this program would work for Catholics and Orthodox Christians?
Oh, I think it would. I mean, I think it's kind of classic Christian spirituality and formation, right? So, and we've had actually, we have someone in our cohort this year who's Orthodox. I'd say, the great thing about Anglicanism, and the terrible thing, but the great thing is it's a big tent, and it's at its best, it's kind of great tradition Christianity. So we are inviting people to be part of our parish life, to pray from the Book of Common Prayer together, to sort of pray this way. What we're studying together is it's just a great tradition. I mean, it's most, especially in the fall semester, it's mostly church fathers. We're reading, Protestants, we're reading Lutherans and Reformed and Catholic and Orthodox, and across the gambit. And I'd say, our fellows come, maybe about half of them come from Baylor and here in Texas, but half of them come from elsewhere. And I'd say about half of them aren't Anglican. When they come, the goal isn't to turn them into Anglicans. It's just to invite them into a way of study and prayer and discernment, and to bless them as they go back to wherever they came from. And so I do think it is, there's something about it that is accessible to all. I will say the most Anglican part about it is this sense that I think Thomas Cranmer had, that ordinary Christians ought to study theology and ought to pray like monks. And I don't think that's completely unique to Anglicanism, but I do think the gift of the Book of Common Prayer and the daily office is this way of saying you could order your life around the prayers of the church, the whole church joining our voices in prayer, and what that will do to us spiritually by being grounded in scripture, by hearing scripture, praying scripture. I think that Cranmer's vision of that is, it's hard to find lived out in many places, but the fellows get the chance to do that. They get to really, I mean, they at 7:15 every morning, they're together praying morning prayer. And they, I'll just say they want it, right? So if you talk about what, one of the things I'm hopeful about this upcoming generation is not everybody, but there is such a hunger among some of them for, they're like, I want someone to tell me what to do. I want discipline. I want a rule. I want to stop relying on my own willpower and how I'm feeling in a given day or a week, and commit myself to things like morning prayer at 7:15 every day. And so, yes, so distinctly Anglican in some ways, and I hope sort of really open to all.
You mentioned a rule of life is a big piece of the language that you use here. What do you specific? I mean, you're already hinting at the answer here, but what do you mean by that specifically? And what do you think is, in the experience of the fellowship so far, what's been the hardest part about developing a rule of life? So what is it? And then what do you think, especially nowadays, what's the biggest challenge for those developing a rule of life?
Yeah, so good. I mean, this is an idea that I think is kind of getting a bit of a resurgence. You know, it was what, 10 years ago, maybe, or 15, that it was all about habits and Jamie Smith and Rule of Life is kind of in right now. There's lots of books and podcasts, which is great. I think it's a really good development. It's a very old notion, right? It's just a regula, a measuring stick, a standard. It's not about actually a list of rules that you have to keep perfectly. It's about being intentional, saying out loud, this is what my life ought to look like, and being able to be accountable to that, right? And so I like to use the metaphor, this is not original to me, but the metaphor of a trellis, right? It's not the thing that's growing, it's not the agent of growth. But a tomato plant needs structure if it's going to grow in the right direction and bear fruit. And so a rule is a way of saying, this is the direction that's going to be fruitful for me to grow in. And one thing I'll just say about it is, I love, again, the sort of that this is getting picked back up, and there's popular books about rules, and I see Baylor students reading them. But historically, a rule is not an individual project. It's not kind of it's you know you think about the sort of modern idea of self-improvement and kind of our own projects of achievement and self-betterment. Rules like Saint Benedict's, they're always held in common. It's actually more about who we are becoming than about just individual growth. And some of the pitfalls of a rule, namely, you might actually be really good at it, and then you'd be in danger, great danger of pride. You might be in danger of thinking like God's real happy with me because I am crushing my rule of life, you know? And a common rule, I think, well, it still has its challenges, avoids at least that pitfall because these are just things we've all agreed to, and you're not exceptional. You're not all that great. You're just doing the thing we've all said we'll do. So there's more accountability that comes from sharing it in common, more support for actually following through, but also less of a propensity to sort of pat ourselves on the back or think, you know, this is one other way in which I'm maximizing my life. So I think that's the heart of it. You know, a challenge, I think two things come to mind as challenges for fellows. One, they do tend to be, as you'd guess, really earnest, really serious. They want to grow. So doing something like slowing down and stopping on Sabbath is actually really painful, right? They're like, they tend to be overachievers. And so we pretty typically about a month and have a conversation about like, hey, how's this sort of Sabbath practice going? And everyone's like, it's brutal. I don't know what to do. I don't like how I feel. It's like stopping and being quiet and like, you know, and we don't overly prescribe how they're supposed to do that, but it's really clear you can't do work or fellows work. You can't do reading for class, you know? So that's just going to be painful, and that's good. That's not a problem. That's one. I think another one is, you know, there is this, I think with anything like Braz's Fellows, there'd be a fear that you kind of associate those rhythms and the habits and the kind of life that you had with a moment. And so it's like, that was great, and now I've moved on. And what do I do? And fellows often worry about this, like, what's going to happen when I finish? Actually, Josh, this is one of the reasons we don't have like a house that the fellows live in. And this is one of the reasons I'm glad we don't, because I think if we had a place where it was like everyone lives together by a rule, as soon as you moved out, it'd be way easier to say, that was awesome. And it was about being in that place, and I'm not there anymore. I think it's actually easier to translate the life of a fellow to whatever they go on to do next, precisely because they had to inhabit that rhythm of study and prayer and work. They were working part-time. They were out in the world. They lived, you know, in an apartment or in the room of a church family, or they found a place with roommates or something. So that actually makes it somewhat easier for them, I think, to translate, you know, how is this habit that I've formed something that I want to continue in? How is it just now part of the life I live?
We'll need to come back to that that question of place at some point. But I think the Sabbath thing. Why is it so hard? Because I can relate to that. I remember. I mean, I'm overweight, and so I thought fasting was going to be the hard part. Like, because I just love food, and the truth was, is it is what, especially when you did it in community, yeah, when we did it as a church in particular, what a difference that made. It seemed, it wasn't, I mean, it wouldn't, it didn't lead to pride so much as, although it can, it didn't lead to pride in this case. It was just like, hey, I did it. And it's qualitatively different.
Yes.
Same thing with the
Yeah.
daily office, same thing with all these disciplines. But Sabbath to me, it's, I'm not nailing it. I mean, it's one thing to, because I think,
Yeah.
especially growing up, you and I are probably the same in this sense. Like Sabbath is just, it's the day you go to church. All right.
Yep. Yep.
Nailed it.
Totally.
But it's so much more than that.
Yes.
And it is unbelievably difficult. Like just not, if I could go a day where I didn't look at my email, it's stressful. Unless I'm like in the woods or something camping and I physically can't do it. And then I,
Yes. Yeah.
But no one's ever
Yeah.
been like, I miss my email. I just wish I could see my
No. No.
inbox
Yeah, that's
ever.
right. Well, and that's a great point because I do think there's some things about our moment and the technologies that we live with that make this difficult in a certain way. Thankfully, I guess, thankfully, it's still an age-old problem. So, I mean, if you read the desert monastics, they're like, I'm so distracted. I'm out here in the desert and I can't pay attention at all. And I'm like, really? You didn't have social media. You probably didn't even have books. So there's something about it that's just a human problem, right? That we're fragmented and we're scattered and it's real hard to attend. And then, of course, yeah, that takes a particular shape when we've got a device designed by billionaires to do that. And it's really good at it. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard. Why is it hard? One of the reasons it's hard is we don't know what rest is. So it's actually easier to stop working than it is to rest. A lot of what we do when we think we're resting is, kind of mind-numbed distraction, or it requires actually not much of us vegging, and so rest is actually more active and more intentional than whatever we might find ourselves doing if we're not being productive, quote unquote. And so, I mean, that's hard. I mean, a text we read at the beginning and at the end of the fellows year is Joseph Pieper's Leisure, the Basis of Culture, which I'm sure your listeners are well familiar with. And every time I reread it, it's just such a challenge to receive reality as a gift rather than something that we accomplish or achieve. Man, it's a hard word to hear again and again, but I need it. We need it. We don't like that. We just don't like a gift that comes that way. And so rather than attend deeply to the gift of reality, we would rather feel like we're accomplishing something for ourselves.
Speaking of gifts, a major piece of this, of course, is the church. And I know that Brazos is associated with Christ Church Waco, right? Is that what it is?
That's right.
What, first of all, just in a practical sense, what role does the church play in your program and what role does it do? And then let's see if I can word this question right. What assumptions about ecclesiology would need to be present for this to succeed in a given community? Because we're going to get later on to your idea, the way you've done Brazos Fellows is meant to be exportable, right, to other places in its own way. And so those assumptions about ecclesiology are going to be important. So what are you doing with at Christ Church Waco to make this happen?
Yeah, the church has been such a big part of it. And in a lot of ways, as I already kind of alluded to, it grew out of the church, a church that from the beginning valued hospitality. And we're not a very old church. We were planted in this iteration in 2014. And not a, depending on what you mean by large, I guess the Anglican world, it's hard to say what normal is, but we're around 200 or so on a Sunday. Anyway, the church really valued hospitality, deeply cared about catechesis. I know you've recently had Alex Fogelman on, and he was part of that here at our parish. And so a deep interest in what it means to catechize people in the faith and to raise up mature Christians who are who are steeped in the basic the basic teachings of the church and have grown in faith and hope and love. So at its very beginning, the fellowship was just a ministry of the church, and we're still literally in the church. We're housed in the church, and we study here, and we're praying here some of the days of the week. We are a 501c3 now, so we've kind of grown to the point that the church needed to launch us, but we have a formal connection with the church. Our board has to be a majority of church members, and the reason is simply, I think a big part of what Brazos Fellows is an invitation to really immerse yourself in the life of a parish. And so everything else we do is great, but some of the most transformative things that happen for fellows is just to be part of a local church that's deeply committed to, the great tradition, to worshiping God, to serving each other. And they get the chance to dive into that in a way that's, I think, probably harder when you're in college, and you're a little bit more scattered. And so, yeah, I'd say the church is really central. If we ask for a show of hands, or if we ask people on a Sunday morning to stand up if you've played some part in Brazos Fellows, it would probably be the vast majority of the parish has helped in some way. And that's been a real gift. The ecclesiology that's operating there, I mean, what a good question. I think it takes really seriously that our life in Christ is not a life alone. So our relationship with the Lord is always personal, but never solitary. And that there are practices that are enriched when we share them. Now, of course, there are, we don't want to forget about or fail to mention the practices that our counterparts. I'm thinking of Bonhoeffer's Life Together here, right, where he talks so beautifully about solitude and community kind of needing each other. So there's times for solitude and silence and retreat and these things. But where two or three are gathered, there I am in their midst. I mean, there's something special that happens when Christ shows up in our presence together. And so I think the ecclesiology is it's taking really seriously that our growth will happen together, not alone. It's going to be centered around the sacraments. So a deep appreciation for gathering around the Eucharist and being made the body of Christ by sharing in his body. And then I would say, lastly on that point, that the for a lot of the fellows who come kind of wondering where they're going to land ecclesiologically, the chance to kind of read deeply from the tradition. And our study, I think, is designed to help us hear and really highly regard what's come before us. So there's a kind of ecclesiology of the dead, or I guess you could say of the living, there, the church in glory, where we are, rather than starting with what's everybody arguing about today, what are the things that I'm most amped up about, what's loudest on social media, asking older questions about more basic realities and listening to the tradition on those questions. I think that is a thing we do in our study that is grounded in an ecclesiology.
I wonder if it could be said, and I'm agreeing with everything you're saying, and I is it that the dominant ecclesiology, especially in Protestant America, we'll just go with that.
Yeah.
I know you've written on this, but I it's almost like there's too narrow of an ecclesiology, right? Maybe that's the right way to say it. I think that there was a moment in my life where the church, capital C Church, which for some that only means the Catholic Church, for some it only means the Orthodox Church. When I say it, I mean the church, small C Catholic, right?
Yeah.
To me, all of a sudden, I shouldn't say all of a sudden, as I learned more, it became such a, it was a larger force. It was more historically rich. It was physically, spiritually larger. More, there was more implications as to what it wasn't. I didn't realize, I should say, probably through you maybe my last year of college or so, that, or the undergrad, that I was treating the church essentially as a support group, right? It was a club. It was at some point it was entertainment, right? But it wasn't the church. It was anything other than the bride and of Christ, the body of Christ. And there's something that I think where you're, when someone goes through this program, they're going to come away with a much deeper and broader ecclesiology. Would you say that that's accurate?
That is the hope for sure. I mean, my experience growing up in a wonderful God-fearing family who introduced me to the gospel and to Christ and in wonderful sort of Bible and Baptist churches, I definitely thought of church as like it's a nice bonus, it's helpful usually, right, in my own personal relationship with Christ. And that's a little like I almost hesitate, like I don't want to disparage these faithful Christians, but it the sort of view of the church that operated was it's kind of a place where we can get charged up to go do the important stuff. And and I think studying scripture and the tradition and learning about church history and realizing how this had been thought of and what it meant to early Christians and throughout the ages. I mean, just seeing how these biblical metaphors work, the metaphor of the body, how is it, you're walking down the sidewalk in Waco and you see a human foot on the sidewalk and you don't think, interesting, there's a foot, it's horrifying. You call the police. It's not, there's nothing alive. There's nothing sort of to be appreciated about just a part of a body in isolation. It's dead, right? And it's something's gone terribly wrong. And so, yeah, I think it's taking seriously that our life in Christ is together. And honestly, one of the gifts of a common rule is we're saying out loud the kind of commitment we're going to have to try to be the body of Christ. And one of the gifts of that is we don't really get to run away when it gets hard. Now, if there's a huge crisis or there's a great failure of leadership or abuse or whatever, of course, people, but for the normal level of hard, you're not going anywhere. And actually, that's a gift, because it's that stability. It's that, like, hey, my growth, my life with God is intimately tied to yours, apparently. And I don't like that right now. And yet, there's something good that's going to happen because we've made this commitment to each other and to these practices. Actually, that is a freeing thing that gives us the freedom to not run away when we'd like to. And how do you, I guess this is one of my questions, Josh, is like, how do we get that? Because it's easy if you've made a solemn vow in front of the Lord to marry somebody, say. I mean, that's not actually easy, but it's clear. It's clear.
It's not ambiguous.
We just a couple of weeks ago or last week had some Cistercian monks join us to read the Benedict's Rule. It was great, a wonderful morning. It's very clear for them. They have made a solemn vow. They are part of this community and they cannot go anywhere.
It's a vow of stability, right?
Exactly. And so there's something that's good there. And like, what does it mean for the rest of us who are not actual monks and outside of things like marriage or being a godparent, which is another vow? I mean, how do we create community that has that level of commitment and stability such that we can have the benefit of that kind of fruit? It's an honest question, right? Brothers and fellows is one way of doing it on a short-term level, but then people say farewell and we say farewell to them in May. And I mean, they stick around, they stay at our church, they put down roots, but the stability that comes with that vow, is there a way to get at that for the rest of us Christians?
Well, I think that gets to a lot of the Cicerone Society loves to talk about the concept of place. And I think that question is deep into what we're trying to say and do and learn, because it's the absence of that sense of place that has been so detrimental to so many local economies and cultures and churches and families. I think we become so transient and so rootless that just trying to attend to the idea of
Yes.
place is radical and profound. And I don't we could take a whole again a whole another podcast. I remember when we went to Belmont Abbey, which has a Benedictine abbey attached to it, Belmont Abbey College, and they were really big on that notion of place. When they read what we said about place, and we had a conference there, they said, "You all sound like Benedictines." And I said, "Well, maybe, we're a bunch of Protestants, so it's going to be a little weird, but we get it, right?" I think there is that vow of stability, because because it's so counterintuitive right now, right? If I take a commitment and say I'm going to stay here in Holland, Michigan, where I live, well, what if the economy goes nuts? What if all of a sudden it starts to become an unsafe place, right? Both those things are not true, by the way. Economy's fine here; it's very safe. But let's say that that changes, right? It doesn't take, especially nowadays, it does not take long for a place to decline. When I think about the other side of where I live here in Michigan, the other side of the state, would I, what's to keep anyone from leaving Flint other than being able to afford it, right? It's a mess. Or Benton Harbor, just south of us. Like, there's just a lot of places where the place is in shambles. Do we have a responsibility to stay there, right? How far does that? Because I'm always thinking of the exceptions, right?
Oh, for
Stability sounds
sure.
great. I would love to be known at a local restaurant, right? The Cheers, right? That to have that experience, and to know the names of the people at the grocery store, and to be familiar with multiple generations of families at this school or something, right? Like where our the life our parents, I don't know about yours, but in my case, would have lived and known. That seems harder now. Yeah, it tremendous. I mean, and I again, I think, you wonder if people are staying in Waco after the Fellows program because they're like, gosh, I finally found the community I can
I
commit.
think so. And I do think, I mean, just to say, we can come back to other churches doing this, but just to gesture toward that, I think if churches want to encourage that kind of stability, they've got to have something robust to invite people into. Like, if church is just a Sunday morning thing and then an afterthought the rest of the week, then why would somebody decide to sort of really put roots down there? Just to add to your being troubled, I'm troubled too. We read in Benedict's Rule in the first, I think, chapter, he's talking about all the terrible kinds of monks. He's like, you got to watch out for the hypocrites, the overly zealous, the hypocrites, worst of all, worse than the hypocrites who know that they are not holy and they're not in it for that and they're just faking it. Worse than the hypocrites are the gyrovagues, which are the monks who go around from monastery to monastery and never settle down. Because that lack of stability means they never actually grow and they flip from one place to another. And Benedict says that's the worst kind of monk. He's like, I don't actually want to talk about it. That's how bad it is, And we read this with the fellows, and all of us, many of them have already transplanted before or did that to come to Brazos Fellows. And we've moved in church traditions, we've gone to college, we don't live where our parents. Anyway, and we're like, what do we do with this? Like, if Benedict is right and there's something about stability that is like basic to actual growth, like how in the world, like what do we do with that? And it's just I don't want to answer that question too quickly because I think it's very hard to answer. It's you could either be really unrealistic, like, well, just do it. It's like, no, it's actually really hard. Or yeah, what happens when the place goes south? And I think there's both a hunger for stability and a real revulsion. I mean, think of the metaphors we use culturally, like get being tied down. What a terrible metaphor for commitment, being tied down.
As if I'm a horse and I have to
Yeah.
stay in.
That's right. And so it's this the cultural scripts we have, the lack of limitation, the all options being open, no long-term commitments. I mean, again, the good news is the emptiness of that has never been more obvious to many. And so the hunger I see in 20-somethings and college students that like they're not interested in that. That is so if we have a positive alternative as Christians in our institutions, in our churches, it's going to be real attractive to some.
Speaking of, and I want to get to the, how this is being exported elsewhere. a big part of the community that you've built, both in the supportive sense at the church, are scholars, established scholars, university professors. These are people who, in many instances, that including myself, have moved around a lot, right? We'd love to take a vow of stability, but it's not exactly easy. And so you and just speaking to my audience in particular, what role, and again, whether it's in Waco or in wherever else you're going to go, what role do scholars and professors and faculty, just professional academics in particular, what role do they play in these kinds of projects? Because I don't think until recently that would have been as clear in many instances, or they saw their ministry exclusively as to the university, which I don't want to take away from that, but. You have folks that are faculty at Baylor, for example, great school. They're doing good work there. Why bother with Brazos? Why bother with, being a scholar in church?
No, it's such a gift to have Baylor and to have these people who just volunteer their time to come, out on a Tuesday or Thursday morning usually, and hang out to read Dante or to read Pieper or Augustine or something. It's really amazing. I mean, I think what I hear from them is one, we're asking them to talk about something they love and to read it with people who are not getting a grade or a degree or a certificate, who are only going to benefit from what they're doing in terms of their study if they are actually transformed. So the invitation is kind of like, do you want to hang out for a morning and talk about one of your favorite texts with a group of people who just want to grow? And not everybody can, I don't want to take it all for granted, the sacrifice of time that that is, but I've just been amazed by how ready they are to say, like, absolutely. And many of them, they're just, doing one or two of these a year for us. And then there are some others who we more regularly lean on. But I think that they, I think that they can see that as the sort of world of higher education continues to shift, there's a real good in thinking creatively about alternative ways of doing classic liberal arts learning, of doing theological study, and that while we need, of course, good colleges, universities, seminaries, the local church can become what I think in a lot of times in church history it has been, which is a place of deep thinking and study. And so we love that. It's a real gift to be able to sort of benefit from having Baylor here and getting to do that with them.
Now we've been hitting at this the whole time. You wrote this book, Practicing Life Together, A Common Rule for Christian Growth. And I see it as a kind of practical and theological apologetic for how to do what Brazos is doing. And now I know there's at least two, maybe three pilot programs that y'all have put in place to say, what would Brazos look? We didn't call it Brazos, but we did the same, a similar model somewhere else, including here in Holland. And I'm just wondering, what's your vision for that? What are you trying to do? And how has that gone so far?
Yeah, it's been really exciting because for a few years there, I'd be talking about Brazos Fellows, and I'd be talking to some pastor or priest somewhere in the country, and be like, gosh, I wish we could do something like that. And for a little while, I was like, well, yeah, I mean, you kind of probably can't, like, it, Baylor is a big part of what we do. But the more we thought about it, and it's not at all to knock the incredible part that Baylor faculty play in what we do, but when I talk to alumni 3, 4, 5 years out of the fellowship, and they talk about what has really shaped their life, the study is a big part of it, but it's not the first thing on the list. It's the spiritual disciplines that they learned and the model of community that have given them a vision for what normal Christian life can be. And so the more we were kind of listening to that, we started to think about, like, okay, so is there something here that could be replicated? Some things could not be exactly the same, of course, but could you take this kind of basic notion of a common rule, church-based experience of formation, and what would that look like? So we put together a handbook for churches And we sent out a draft to maybe 20 or so different people around the country. And the feedback was just like, yes, this is great. And a couple churches said, like, we just want to start one now. And so something that we thought about, maybe someday other churches could do this. It turns out that the basic model is really adaptable to what you have in your church context. So yeah, we have a couple that are now in their second year. We have a third one that's getting ready to launch in August. And there's probably a dozen other churches who are in serious conversation in their own community about doing something like this. The goal is not to franchise or to create a kind of top-down network, but we love the idea of reimagining how the local church can be a parish where real deep formation happens. And for some churches, they're probably already doing most of it. And it'd be just a way of saying, oh, here's a structure and here's a language, a grammar for what we already are trying to do that we can invite other people into. So we're really excited to see where that goes. And our role here in Waco is just to say, we can tell our story, we can share some resources, we can give away some stuff, and provide a little bit of coaching and conversation dialogue partner with churches that want to see something like this happen in their context.
Yeah. A lot of great opportunities there. It reminds me of several years ago, I was in an interview for a job at a Christian study center. And I may have shared this story on the podcast before, but it was I asked those interviewing me what they could do, what they wish they could do differently. And so I just want to say, Christian study centers is different than Brazos, but because the Christian study centers, it's a movement focusing on the students while they're at college, right, and developing these kind of communities, et cetera. But one of the things that it was a board member who had been part of the Christian study center. Now she had moved on. She was married, still living in the same community. But she said, "I just wish this that the community I found at that Christian study center could continue, right?" And so in her mind, she's like, "I just what I found at the Christian study center, I don't. I moved away." To this town in the same state, but I have a great church. I love these people, but I don't have that same, vibe, for lack of a better word. And I think that's a really encouraging development and model, because what you're saying is we don't need to have Brazos North, East, West, and South. We don't need to. It doesn't have to be a multi-campus project. It's saying, oh no, here's a blueprint, a model, a schematic. And take it to your place, and do likewise, but in a way that's unique to Holland or Canton or Indianapolis, or I don't know where else you're at, Orlando. All these different places you can go, where the distinctiveness of the culture and the church and the community and the economy and the whatever that can feed into who you're trying to be as a program, right?
I think that's exactly right. And this could come across the wrong way. I'm just going to say it. It almost doesn't matter what you do. It almost doesn't. I think what matters in terms of the content of the program, like if you're inviting people to commit together for a time to a rule together, and that rule is going to include things like prayer, studying scripture in the tradition, sharing meals around the table. Like, it's actually not that complicated. That's not to say it's easy. It takes time, it takes investment, but it's not rocket science. And I think we maybe underestimate one, ordinary Christians' desire for that kind of robust life of prayer and study. And we overrate how hard it would be to kind of create a structure for that to become normal. Let me just give one example. So we started a few years ago inviting parishioners who couldn't be full-on fellows but wanted to study. We invited them to come take our course, and we called them parish scholars. And they, I mean, it was a real commitment. Tuesday, Thursday mornings, reading, basically grad level seminar kind of reading load. And it was really great to have them, homeschooling mom, empty nesters, second career people. And I approached one of our parishioners a couple of years ago and said, you really should consider this. And she said, like, no, I am not. You've got the wrong person. I'm not an intellectual. I'm not an academic. And I was like, I think you're wrong. And then two or three other people also told her that she should do it. And so she's like, okay, I get it, Lord. All right, I hear you. She ended up taking the course. She absolutely thrived. Yeah, she's not, she happens to be married to a guy with a PhD who's one of the smartest people I've ever met. Yeah, she's not that level of intellect, but she read Athanasius and Augustine and Cyprian and Aquinas and Julian of Norwich and Dorothy Sayers. I mean, she drank deeply. She didn't get it all perfectly right, but she,
Neither do we.
nobody does. Nobody does. And her summary, sort of little presentation at the end of the year to the parish about what she'd learned was one of the most beautiful and perfectly worded summaries of what we hope the course to be that anyone's ever given. And now she's leading a lay group in our church and reading Robert Louis Wilkin, The Spirit of Early Christian Thought. She's reading like serious historical theology, and they're all lay people. None of them are experts or clergy, and they're doing theology together because she's gotten this taste that it can be fruitful in this kind of way for her life and for her faith. And I just think we vastly underrate that ordinary Christians, they want to think deeply, they want to grow, they want to wrestle. They're capable of this kind of life. And that's not everybody. Not everybody will go for that. But if we invite it, if we set the table and we invite people to show up, some of them are going to come.
And some won't, and it's okay. I mean,
Exactly.
we want everyone there, but at the same time, you're right. There is a sense in which, like, the Lord builds the church, right? The Lord
Yeah.
builds these things. I mean, this has been true for Ciceronian society. The way people have found us over the years, half the time it doesn't make any sense to me. It's like, you found us how?
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah.
where did you come from? And I think there is a lot of truth to the fact that the Lord's up to something, and you know, the goal is to follow him, and not get in the way in a way. We can't go through your whole book. This is a great book, y'all. I just want to encourage you to take a look at it. It's really practical. It helps paint a vision of what this could look like in any context. And just it's very accessible. You know, anyone could pick this up and read it. You can tell that Paul is well read, but he's also well experienced in this and knows that, you know, he's speaking to a very broad range of people. The part three is learning to wonder, which is the life of study, which for the Ciceronian society is going to be a big piece of this, our focus on
Yeah.
intellectual discipleship and things like that. Obviously, the other parts are just as important, but you're right. Well, one of the interesting distinctions you made there that I had never heard before was a distinction between curiosity and study, where
Yeah.
curiosity, to make say this really crudely, is bad. And I was like, "What?
Yeah.
Come on!" But then you explain what you meant by that. And again, I don't ever recall seeing that before. Can you just outline what you meant by that distinction between curiosity and study, and how
Yeah.
rule of life might attend to that distinction?
Totally. Yeah, and this is not original. Again, nothing. Hopefully, very little is. It's all being cribbed from Paul Griffiths. He's cribbing mostly from Augustine. So it's just a lot of people borrowing, which is great. But yeah, Griffiths has this short series of lectures on the vice of curiosity that I think at some point then get turned into a book. And he talks about how for the ancient world, for folks like Augustine, curiositas is a vice. It's the desire to sort of possess knowledge, to be known as someone who knows, to control and master knowledge for our own selfish gain. So it's actually not what we typically are talking when we say like, childlike curiosity. We're actually probably talking mostly about something more like wonder. But Griffith's point is that the modern university is premised on this vice being actually a virtue, that knowledge is something that we acquire for ourselves, that we possess for our own gain, that is competitive, that is surface level, that novelty is to be prized, making new contributions. And so it's one of the first, it might be the first reading that Brazos fellows do in the year. When we start our course, we're like, why should we study at all? And Griffiths is like, maybe don't. Or at least you're going to have to unlearn everything you thought about study, right? And so in contrast, studiousness, the virtue of studiousness is recognizing that our knowledge is participatory. So anything that you and I can know is already known by God, and we only know it because God allows us to participate, to share in his knowledge. This means that knowledge is gift, not something to be hoarded, used for our own gain, not something that can be a source of pride, but rather is meant to be something of delight. And Griffiths concludes that all study, especially theological study, ought to be the work of amateurs, rather than professionals. So he doesn't mean sloppy, he just means lovers, like people who love it. And I think I have multiple grad degrees. I love the sort of scholarly world. I love academic conversations sometimes. But this sense that not that study is primarily a thing we do because it's somehow professionally useful is one, it's so pervasive, and two, it's such a way to kill the joy of actual intellectual life. And so that distinction between the sort of vicious way and the virtuous way of approaching study is, I think, I find it, profoundly convicting every time I reread it. The fellows are all kind of undone, and many of them want to go to grad school, and they read it and they're like, oh no. And that's good.
Yeah, right.
Maybe they still should and will, but like it's good to have that troubling first. So yeah, I'd highly recommend if anybody wants to read more about that, definitely you can look at the book, but you can also go straight to the source and get Griffiths, who will be getting it from Augustine.
Yeah. There are two things that come to mind. There is, going back to the trying to unlearn what college is for, and why I think there's this free fall after we graduate undergrad. College students can get so freaked out about what major they pick. Like, if they pick the wrong major, they take the wrong class, they get the C, their life is over, everything, they're going to fail at everything. I mean, I experienced that myself at one point, at some point, but it's so sad that that's the way we think about these things, as if it is every. And so where I'm going with this is that's more like that curiositas. Yeah, did I say that right? Curiositas. Yeah. But there's also the other side of it, which I began to encourage students to think more about, is, okay, when you're picking a major, when you're picking a class or some line of study, what do you who are you going to serve with it? Who are you going to love with it? Right? I mean, it's a good in and of itself, right? I think studying literature and philosophy, even if you don't use it to teach or something right away, I think if it doesn't lead to a level of vanity, but I think there can be, it's another way to look at it is, why am I doing this to love and serve God, and then to also love and serve others? And that's qualitatively different. I also think there's, going back to the academic writing, because I have noticed, both in my own writing and in what other people have written, you can tell when someone loves their subject and when they're just writing it because they're either just trying to show off or get a publication, right? This book was a line on the CV, and you're just talented enough to write a book about something you don't actually like that much, right? But then you read a book by someone who, they really, really love this. They're not trying to impress you. They're not trying to get a tenure with this piece. What they're trying to do is, I want to love this truth into existence in a way, or love this truth in a way the truth already exists. Anyways, you know what I'm trying to say. It's
100%.
it is so qualitatively different. And I think there's a lot of time I spent, wasted, quite frankly, writing on things to get the good grade, or just get that job. Right. There's a temptation, especially among conservatives and Christians, like, we want to hide so we can get that job, sneak into that secular university, get a bunch of money, and get the high paying job. And then, all surprise, after tenure, hey, I'm a conservative, I love Jesus. It's a life sucking strategy, because you end up writing on things you don't love in order to make that work. But anyway, I could go on about that. I just
No,
go ahead and comment.
I completely agree. And I mean, there's so many versions of this. Even and these are good things, right? But even something like apologetics, where it's we're really studying just so that we have really good arguments to demolish, the atheists or something. That there's a place for apologetics and there's a place for good reasoned, debate and argument. But if we confuse that with the kind of actual work of theology where the object of our study is the infinite triune God, eternal God, where really the only purpose ought to be for us to love and worship that God. Theology becomes, we actually reduce theology down to, we instrumentalize it, right? And that temptation with all kinds of learning is, I think it's just so pervasive that if we don't know to what use we can put this and how it will help our tribe or our side or our CV or our job, then what's the point? And that's the enemy of wonder. That's the enemy of deep attention. And it's certainly the enemy of love. And as you're saying, love is the infectious thing. If you're around a teacher who loves what they're talking about, you will love it, given enough time. That's where learning and transformation happens. We want to love something that's worth loving. And so when we see someone do that work of attending, and I say in the book, I mean, this is maybe this is hot take. Hot take portion here, but every Christian is called to be a theologian. Every Christian. That doesn't mean every Christian is called to go to grad school and seminary. That's not what being a theologian means. Doesn't mean they have to do even the kind of reading that we're talking about here. But we love, we want to know more about the one we love. And we're called to love the Lord with our mind. This is to say that for most Christians, you can think of the exceptions, but for most Christians with a sort of typical literacy and intellectual capability, we're actually commanded to think deeply and lovingly about God. And so there's a lot of work there to do in demolishing the sort of, this is for the professionals, this is for those who it's their career, this is to sort of win arguments. It's actually part and parcel of the faithful Christian life to study in this way. And for those of us who have advanced degrees and are in and out of academia and involved in different ways, it's a real challenge to say, like, how can we put ourselves in a position where we're invited to do that again, that kind of study? For me, it's like I got to find ways to read things that I'm not, like, I'm going to be a novice in. I'm going to really, it's going to humiliate me some. I'm going to have to, like, it's going to be hard. That's not always pleasant or easy, but it, that kind of getting outside of our comfort zone is maybe part of how we can correct the way that we've been formed.
All right. Well, Paul, I got two more questions left, and I want to make sure I give you a chance. The first one is, if you've been listening to this and you're like, man, I would love to participate in Brazos Fellows, how does someone go about applying? When do they do it, and what does it involve?
Yeah, totally. They can just go to BrazosFellows.com, BRAZOS Fellows.com. And there it's easy to read more, to watch some videos, to request an application. And presently we're taking applications for the 2026, 2027 cohort. Those years are apparently real. That doesn't sound real. We're taking applications now and up through March 1st. And yeah, we'd love anybody who is intrigued to shoot us an email. We can I'd love to chat and set up a time we can talk, but you can find all that on the website there. And it's a I would just say, if you're somebody who has the flexibility to kind of think creatively about what's next and you want to be part of a community that's going to help you commit to disciplines and commit to this kind of growth, then consider applying.
Excellent. And one last question, unrelated to anything, but related to the fact that this is either coming out before or after Christmas. What's your favorite Christmas movie?
Oh my goodness. I mean, it's not close for me. It's A Wonderful Life.
Okay. All right.
I just
Why?
grew up on it, and it, I actually can't I can't watch it without, like, if I'm not ready to get, emotional and teary. It just brings me back to being a young kid. But I haven't yet shown it to my kids. I'm like, it's actually, I'm kind of surprised I watched it as young as I did. Like, it starts with a suicidal guy.
You have to explain that to the kid. Like, yeah, this is Merry Christmas, kids. This guy wants
Yeah,
to.
exactly.
Okay, well, that's. We did an episode a few weeks ago on Christmas traditions, and I've been asking people that. Mine, by the way, since you asked, is it's either the star. You ever see that cartoon, The Star?
Oh yeah.
It's
Yeah, it's
really
been a
good.
long time.
Yeah, it's really good. I recommend that. I also love the Santa Claus, which I believe
Oh
basically
yeah.
was true. I mean, I growing up, I figured Tim Allen was Santa Claus. Still a little surprised that he's not. I'll get over it. But that was good. Well, Paul, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm so glad you're here. Have a very Merry Christmas.
Thanks, Josh. You too. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, you've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. We'll be having our 2026 conference at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, March 12th through the 14th. Sponsorship opportunities are still available, and by the way, prices will go up starting on January 2nd for that. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Thanks for listening.